This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, my guest today is someone really special, and so I'm going to start it off with a song. And her name is Dorian Hannaway.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Good morning. Good morning. It's great to stay up late. Good morning. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Dorian Hannaway.
Good morning. How are you today, Patsy?
Oh, well, great. It's so wonderful. And, of course, that song tells us what this book is all about. It's just wonderful. You know, I am so excited to have you on because I have been singing that song to my children.
Oh.
Actually, my mother sang it to me.
And
every morning, there are very few mornings that I don't wake up singing that song.
Oh, terrific. It's a great song.
It is a great song, and I'm so excited to have you on today to talk about Debbie Reynolds, of course, and your friendship with her and how you came out to write these books about her.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about it. Thank you.
Okay, so let's start. The new book is
Make 'em Laugh.
Make 'em Laugh. And that's
short-term memories of longtime friends.
And she has made so many people laugh, but you had already done one book with her before.
That's correct. We did Unsinkable in 2013.
And I love that book.
I did too.
That was fun. And so the new book is you manage really to capture her personality and capture her stories in such a unique and fun way. And this book, with all of the stresses and strains that everybody's been going through over the past year or so, I think it is just a wonderful book for people to read, just to relax you, to put you in a different frame of mind. And Debbie Reynolds is the epitome of somebody who never gives up.
That's the truth. She's an Aries. She just keeps going. An amazing woman.
Well, I'm an Aries too, and of course, she's very special because she was born on April 1st.
Right.
Wow. So she probably had people teasing her all her life about
that. She's heard every joke that there is about April 1st. I think.
Well, tell us. You've written this book in such a nice way. One feels that one is sitting there with you, the two of you.
Well, I was very fortunate when it's so important as a writer to, when you're collaborating with someone, to write in their voice. And I'm very fortunate to have been friendly with Debbie since 1981. We met in 1981. My first writing job with her was doing an act, which she was doing at the MGM Theater in Las Vegas. She did an impression of an entertainer named Madam, Waylon Flowers and Madam. And I was Madam's manager at the time, and Waylon suggested that I write for Debbie. And it was amazing. It was a wonderful experience. She taught me really how to be a writer. Before that, I was just funny. And I was, writing jokes and things like that, but I didn't know structure, and she's the one who really taught me from her knowledge as a graduate of the MGM studio system, where they had to learn everything. And script was very important to her, so I was very fortunate to have come up with her for many years. So the highest compliment for these books is that people say it sounds like you're having a conversation with her, which I did have many conversations with her, but when you sit down to write 80,000 words, a lot of them are mine, okay?
Exactly, and that's what I was so thrilled to find in this book. I forgot, you know, that you guys weren't in the room with me. I'm sitting there drinking my coffee and just listening in.
It's wonderful. That's a high compliment. Thank you.
So, as you said, you've talked to her over the years, and now when she, after the Unsinkable book, which I thought was just marvelous, so she wanted to sort of catch up on some of the stories that she hadn't told before.
Right. A lot of people said, well, why didn't you talk about this, and why didn't you talk about that? And Unsinkable was very specific in that it began at where her first memoir ended. She did a memoir in 1984 with David Patrick Columbia, which was the story of her, you know, her early life and her first two marriages. And she ended it on a high note with her third husband, who she touted as her soulmate and gentle and wonderful and all that. And by the time we got around to writing Unsinkable, he had stolen everything she had. So it was a whole different, she did not want to leave on that note. So Unsinkable was a way to tell the story from that point of view. And also, she hadn't really talked a lot about her films in her first memoir. So I felt, as of someone who loves her films and someone who loves film, I feel it's important to get the artist's perspective on their, you know, what the filmmaking process was. So we did the second half of the book. We just went through her body of work, and she talked about every single movie. Some movies she didn't even remember being in, because at MGM she said some days you'd show up, they'd put you in hair and makeup, and you would go do what they said, which could be standing having a Coke with Vic Damone in a movie that was not anything that she was really in. It was just a cameo. So I'd say, well, you were listed in this movie. And she'd go, oh, I didn't remember that. So sometimes she snuck in, and sometimes she was the star, which was the great thing about the studio system. And she was very fortunate to be in that last wave of really big musicals that came out of MGM.
Oh, and even now, when every time I sort of shiver every time I think of Singing in the Rain, it is.
Oh, it's the best.
It is. There's nothing as good as that. I love musicals, but this one, I remember the first. Well, I remember, of course, watching it with my boys, who watch it all the would watch it all every time it came on, because they just loved the music. It, of course, they'd heard me sing. I think they appreciated somebody else's voice, but it just puts a smile on your face.
Right, it's certainly. I mean, and she was only 19. She was 18 when she got the part, 19 when she made the movie, and 20 when it was released. So that was a really important time for her, because she just had done two movies at MGM, and her third was at Singing in the Rain, and it was such an important film for her. And also, it was Gene Kelly's, you know, real, you know, debut as a director on his own. I mean, he had directed American in Paris, and he'd worked, you know, and gotten great acclaim for that. But this was really something he was very vested in. And here she was with no real dancing experience. And it was a tough, I asked her, I said, how did you get through this? She said, I knew it would either finish me off or I would get through it. And I wasn't about to let it kill me. And it just about did. But she worked so hard. And you would never know looking at that movie. I mean, if you really deconstruct it, there are some, like in the Good Morning number, there are some scenes where they put her up on a stool or put her someplace and dance around her, which is, you know, a device so she doesn't have to do all the things. But she was step for step with both of those really experienced dancers, with Donald and with Gene Kelly.
And they were, I mean, those two just by themselves were such amazing dancers. And
so extraordinary.
And as you say, she just blends in so seamlessly. It takes your breath away when you watch it.
Right. Well, Gene Kelly was very cognizant of playing to everyone's strengths. And he was a really great director, even though she worked tirelessly with three other choreographers all day long. I mean, she really, you know, she worked very, very hard. And it was, I mean, that Charleston number, the, you know, all I do the whole day through is dream of you, that number really played to her athleticism, and the Charleston number was very athletic. And that was something that really was a nice showcase for her. And the other ones, you know, You Were Meant for Me with Gene Kelly was a very romantic number and very, very different in tone from the rest of them. So she had a lot of work to do in very different areas, but those tap numbers are killers.
Well, it's still hard to believe that she just went into it, you know, at such a young age.
Well, but when you know her, you know that nothing ever stops her. I mean, she has met every challenge in her life with grace and hard work. I mean, that's who she is.
Well, I think it's wonderful now that the younger generation are able to see these films and to be able to see such talent. When, you know,
right.
after Singing in the Rain, of course, she was a star. I mean, it was like an instant star.
That was a movie that really made her a star. And she said when she went to the premiere with Robert Wagner as her date, she said when she saw her name on the screen, she thought she had arrived at that moment.
Well,
it was really an epiphany for her. She thought, I think I've made it.
Well, to be with Robert Wagner and to have your name up there, absolutely.
Right.
So from there, how did she handle the next phase of her life?
Which phase?
You know, going after her next film, how did she decide what film to do?
She decided her films up until, for the next 12 years. They put her in lots of different movies for, you know, she did Tender Trap with Frank Sinatra. She did all kinds of, you know, movies that, she did The Catered Affair. She had to fight for that. And shortly after, she was 20, I think she was 22 when she met Eddie Fisher. So that began a whole new chapter in addition to her filmmaking. That really began her celebrity.
Well, you know, The Catered Affair is really underrated because it is an excellent film. And
excellent
she did
performances. And the director was very hard on her. He was extremely, I interviewed Hank Moongene, who was the assistant, associate director on that film. And he's talked about, the director slapping Debbie across the face in front of the crew. I mean, he was really hideous to her. You know, he used to call her Miss Hollywood because she was on the phone with Eddie when she wasn't working. And she didn't feel she had the experience, but she did a wonderful job. And the crew was so mad at Mr. Walters that they ran over his foot with a camera and broke his toes.
Oh. Well, it certainly showed her acting chops. I mean, she could act.
Absolutely. And she said that Miss Davis and Mr. Borgnine were both extremely generous with her, and they were both, they both helped her with her scenes, and she listened to both of them and loved both of them for the rest of their lives. I mean, they became very close friends for, as long as they lived.
And it was a risky role for a young actress because it wasn't, it was a tough role.
It was very tough.
So
it was a difficult script, and it was not difficult, but it was certainly not
demanding,
not Abba Dabba Honeymoon. It was a different tone, and it was a serious drama, and she played it perfectly. I mean, she really did a great job.
And so that, of course, that was at the time of the Eddie Reynolds romance, Eddie Fisher romance, and. And I said Eddie Reynolds because probably that's what got the
Eddie
whole problem.
Eddie Reynolds, right?
That exactly. You know, still when you go back and you see them, you could see who the dominant personnel.
Well, it's interesting to see because that was one of the first really big scandals when Elizabeth lost her husband and Eddie lost and Debbie lost hers. I mean, it was a really difficult time, and even though they were. They were young. I mean, she was only 28, I think, at the time. She may have been even younger, I think, because she was 24 when Carrie was born, 26 when Todd was born. So she was like 27, 28 years old. And to be in the middle of this national, worldwide scandal, I mean, the Pope denounced Elizabeth. I mean, it was like everybody was in on this, and it was just, it was a really challenging thing for her with two young children. It was very difficult, and her family moved in and stayed with her and the kids and took care of them, and it was really, you know, everybody was on deck for Debbie and the kids. So it was a challenge, but it was something, again, that she went through gracefully, and actually he gave her a wealth of material for the rest of her nightclub career.
That's true. Yeah, I did see her do one of those nightclub things, and yes, you're right. A lot of material.
She just has to mention Eddie Fisher, and that and she gets a laugh.
Exactly.
Her audience remembers.
And all during this time, of course, she had her two children, and.
Right.
And I think she set an example from the point of view of, you know, wanting to protect her children. And she certainly got the sympathy of all of America at that time.
Right. It's true. It's funny. Even to this day, people just still take sides. You know, people of a certain age still say to her, you know, I was always on your side. My parents, I remember we went to see Molly Brown when I was a kid. And my father said, "Boy, I'll bet Eddie Fisher's sorry he left her."
You're right. My mother
talked about it for years, decades afterwards.
My mother was also very involved. It was really, as you said, one of the first really international scandals,
right.
There was a lot of talk at the time about it.
Right.
So,
it was,
you know,
was really amazing.
During that time, she made quite a few movies.
Yes.
Which ones did she like of those movies that she made during that time?
Well, Molly Brown is her favorite. I mean, that was that movie she said captures her personality more than any. I mean, that's her. That really is Debbie. I mean, the unsinkable character who just, you know, keeps fighting, keeps going on, doesn't care if her clothes are ripped or she has a pie in the face. That's her. I mean, she really is that woman. And she's gracious, and I think that's her favorite movie. And she loves them all. I mean, she loved working with Albert Brooks and Mother. I mean, that was something that was really an extraordinary performance. And she loved working with him.
Now, when you were talking to her about all these films, sometimes it must have been difficult for her to think of all of the people that she's worked with.
It was funny. We screened What's the Matter with Helen, which was... excuse me, I just thought of Shelley Winters trying to kill her in that movie. And she literally, because Shelley was so off her nuts sometimes and such a method actress, she had the prop people hide all the real knives because she was really afraid that Shelley would stab her to death, you know, just as part of the acting. But as we were watching it, she goes, you know, Dennis Weaver was a really good kisser. And I was like, really? And she said, yeah, she said, I wasn't getting any love at home at that time. She said, so I was really happy to do those scenes, which was cute. She said, he had a lovely wife, and we never got any further than that. But she said, but I really enjoyed that. She also said Frank Sinatra was a great kisser. Frank Sinatra and she did The Tender Trap. At the time, she was engaged to Eddie, and Mr. Sinatra tried to talk her out of marrying Eddie Fisher because he was a crooner. And she said, he'll never be faithful, he'll never be, you know, he'll break your heart. And she was determined to marry him, but she, you know, she remembered his words much later on.
When, as a matter of fact, you know, the movie with Shelley Winters, you're right, there was something sort of demonic about Shelley Winters in that
movie.
Right,
well, Shelley was method. I mean, she was the Strasberg, you know, method actress. And she, you know, and that scared Debbie because she was really hardcore when she was in that part, and she was living it. And some actresses and actors do that. I mean, they go into character for the length of the film, and that's their process, which is, you know, we must respect, but not when there's a knife in their hand. You know, it was just something that really, you know, she said this could be tragic, so she made them hide the real sharp objects around Shelley.
That's funny. I'm going to play a song, one of my favorite songs. It's the kind of song when you get it in your head, you can't get it out of your head.
Oh,
but everybody will recognize this.
Okay.
I hear the cottonwoods whispering above. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. The old hooty owl, hooty hoos to the dove. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. Does my lover feel what I feel when he comes near? My heart beats so joyfully. You'd think that he could hear. Wish I knew if he knew what I'm dreaming of. Tammy, Tammy, Tammy.
That song, that voice, you know, first of all, it's such a distinctive voice.
Right.
And I hate to say this, but there are so many modern singers whose voices I don't recognize. And when this song comes on, everybody knows that's
right.
Debbie.
Right. It's wonderful. And she had a lot of interesting things to say about that movie also. She was pregnant with Carrie when she made that, which didn't stop her one minute. And she had difficulty with Leslie Nielsen. Not difficulty in that he was a difficult person, but she couldn't crack him. You know, she was really fun and all that, but he stayed in character. And he was another New York method person, and he took this very seriously and didn't want to really, he wanted to get into Hollywood, which is ironic since the movies that he's most famous movies are the Airplane and the all the crazy movies he did with the Zucker brothers. I mean, he was so much known for his comedy later on. He wanted really nothing to do with it in the early 50s. He wanted to do serious. He wanted to be in the Brando school of filmmaking at the time. And he was really. She said she got along better with the goat than she did with him, but that was just her making a joke.
Well, you never know. My grandmother had a goat, and she got along better with the goat sometimes.
I love goats.
So you never know. But so,
right.
She enjoyed making the film. Other than
she
that,
she did enjoy making the film, and she loved Walter Brennan, who played her father, and he was someone who taught her how to, you know, how to look in one eye. She said, look in my downstage eye when you play to me. So then your face is in three quarters and you get a better screen angle. And he knew how to steal a scene. He and Thelma Ritter taught her how to steal scenes because they did everything. All they needed was a mask and a gun, those two. They could, you know, they were so distinctive as actors. They could really upstage almost anybody. And she loved working with Walter Brennan. There's a scene at the staircase where she wears the gown at the plantation, and she gives a speech as part of the party to, explain the history of the family. And it's just exquisite. She did a beautiful job in that movie. And, of course, it was just a wonderful romantic story. And everybody named their kids Tammy. After that, I have a cousin named Tammy. There's an epidemic of Tammys and Debbies in the 50s and early 60s in our country.
Now, you know, when I introduced you, I said, you know, of course, your name is Dorian
right.
Hannaway.
Right.
And I just wanted to tell people a little bit about you because how you've been involved in show business for quite a few years yourself.
Yes, I have, actually.
And how did you get involved in show business?
Well, I got in a very strange way, actually. When I grew up in Philadelphia, near Philadelphia, and in 1973, I went to see Bette Midler perform at the Academy Theater in Philadelphia, and it changed my life. I thought, I could sing. I could go do that. So I moved to New York City to be a singer. Well, apparently it's not as easy as it looks. So I sang in nightclubs and things like that. But I got a day job at the William Morris Agency, which at the time was the biggest talent agency in the country. So I got into I went into that company as an assistant and got into the agent trainee program. And from there, went into, you know, working with acts and working with you know, I was there for 6 years. I left them in 1981 to manage Waylon Flowers and Madam, and that's when I first started writing. And I started writing for him because he was always laughing. I was always funny. And he would say, write that down, right? Give me a joke. And I would go to the TV tapings with him and write jokes, material for him on the fly. And I would go to Hollywood Squares with him, and, you know, I would just fill in Deb. I was working with Debbie and writing her nightclub act. And in, I was writing and producing until 1988, there was a Writers Guild strike. And nobody could get a job in Hollywood. The writers were all on strike. So after that was over, I went to the closest studio to my house, which was CBS, which is 15 blocks from my house in West Hollywood. And I got a job there where I stayed for 20 years and became a network executive where I supervised shows like David Letterman and the Late Late Show with Tom Snyder and The Kids in the Hall and The Late Late Show with Craig Kilborn and with Craig Ferguson. And that was what I did for 20 years.
Wow.
That's... And when I left there, I started working with Debbie full time, and thankfully she wanted to, you know, write books. I'd never written a book, but she wouldn't work with anybody else. She had met with other people, other authors, but she said, no, I want to work with Hannaway. And she always calls me Hannaway because my nickname is Dory, but when she was at MGM, she despised Dory Sherry. So she just couldn't bear to call me Dory, so she called me Hannaway all the time. So that's what she calls me.
Well, you have done what every author always hopes to do with their fictional characters, to capture a voice. And in your case, you have captured Debbie's voice, which is just so wonderful when it comes to reading a book like this. As I said, it's just a wonderful read. It's so nice to have something like this to pick up, to read. And when we're talking about Debbie Reynolds' spirit, wow. She is incredible. I have to take a quick commercial break, but I want you to hold on because I want to come back and I want to talk to you about Debbie Reynolds' attitude of never giving up, of really facing, and boy, has she faced problems in her life. Okay, so hold on. Okay. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
888-346-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Hi, this is Patsy with the Z, and I'm back with my guest, Dorian Hannaway, who co-authored Make 'Em Laugh with her good friend, Debbie Reynolds. Hi, Dory.
Hi.
Okay, well, it's so wonderful to have you back on, and I'm going to talk. I want to talk about her Debbie Reynolds spirit, but let's just run through, just for people, a little bit of some of the people that she talks about in the book and some of her stories. We mentioned already Frank Sinatra. What did she think of Phyllis Diller?
Oh, she and Phyllis were great friends, and she would go up to Phyllis's house with a casserole that her friend Donald Light would make for Phyllis, and we put the recipe actually into the book. And it was they would go up to the house and they would have dinner, and they would go out to the nightclubs, and they would go to a place where there was a jazz band, and these two broads would keep the band on they would get up on the bandstand, sing, they would get in front and dance. And when the place closed, they would pay them to stay open so they could sing and dance in another hour or so. And everybody loved it. I mean, they were just, you know, they loved to have fun together and laughed and carried on. And it was just, there was nobody like Phyllis. And, of course, there's nobody like Debbie. They're both such unique characters, but great, great friends.
Oh, I love Phyllis Diller's humor. And I can't even imagine how much fun it would have been to have the two of them together, like,
oh yeah,
amazing. What about Lucille Ball? How did she?
Lucille Ball was a friend for a very long time, and she loved Lucy. And she used to take her Girl Scout trick or treating on the street where Lucille Ball lived and Jack Benny lived, and they would just go up the street, and all these famous movie stars lived in these, you know, houses, and she would go, and she would always they would get candy from all these famous stars. They would open the door and Jack Benny would be there, and he'd give you every little one of the girls a nickel. And
oh wow, that's big of him.
That was big in those days for him.
Yeah, for him. Wow, a nickel.
Right, but it was just one of those streets where I think Glenn Ford and Agnes Moorehead, a lot of her friends lived on that street, and they just would go up and trick or treat, and it was fun for everybody. But Lucy was someone that she knew, and she had fun with, and she would always go to visit Lucy and would take her, you know, she'd always leave something behind, so she had an excuse to go back and get it. You know, she'd always leave something, you know, like a bracelet or something of hers, she would leave there, so Lucy would call her and say, you left your bracelet behind, can you come and get it, you know, and she would have another excuse to go visit. So she was always, she loved her, adored her.
Well, you know, they, of course, went through the same horror of... Of very public divorces from very famous husbands. And so I assume they had some good words about that sometimes.
Right. Well, they commiserated about that. But honestly, what Debbie said when Miss Ball married Gary Morton, she said he made him laugh. She made her laugh all the time. He made her so happy that she really was just content and really had a wonder. But she never stopped loving, Desi, ever. She never stopped loving him. Even when he was sick and dying, she would go to see him, and she really loved him, you know, very dearly. And there was a picture in Debbie's house, which was it's in the book. It's her at the Friars Club where they were honoring Lucille Ball, and it's Debbie with all these amazing comics. It's Bob Hope and George Burns and Jack Benny and Milton Berle. Everybody's standing around Lucy. And so we wrote about everybody who's in that picture. She had stories to tell about every single one of those famous comics, and it makes for a nice part of the book where she reminisces about all those close friends of hers.
Well, that's exactly what I said, that you captured that feeling of intimacy, of
Thank
her just chatting about people she knew and making us feel like we're sort of part of her family.
Well, that's good.
It is remarkable that she did have a Girl Scout troop.
Oh, well, she was very active in that. Her friend Sandy Abshin became troop leaders. I mean, she was doing the singing nun at the time, and on her lunch break, in her nun's habit, drove over to the school for this meeting, and the teachers and everybody see this nun sitting there, and there was like, I'm sorry, this is non-denominational. They were just, but so she wanted to have a place for Carrie to, you know, Debbie was a very honored Girl Scout when she was growing up. She had 39 merit badges, and she wanted very much for her daughter to have that same experience. Of course, Carrie hated it, and most of her girlfriends, you know, were people like, I'm trying to think. It was the gentleman that was on early television. Not Neil Simon. Well, actually, his daughter. It was people like that. It was who were part of the Girl Scout troop. It was all these kids from famous parents.
Sort of the 90210.
Right, exactly. And they would go up to Harold Lloyd's estate for parties. But she would also include, in addition to the privileged children that were in her troop, she would include troops from other neighborhoods that weren't so fortunate. And these kids would go up to the Harold Lloyd estate, and they would be stunned at to see a two-story Christmas tree. I mean, they thought they were in a department store. They were absolutely gobsmacked by the amazing things that some people had. So it was just she always was very inclusive with other people that weren't as fortunate as she. She worked very diligently with charity all her life, the Thalians, and was one of her great charities. She did that for more than 40 years, I believe. She built a building at Cedars-Sinai Hospital here in Los Angeles for the mental health, people with mental health needs. She's been very active in charity and is also very noted for her love of collecting, because nobody used to collect costumes and props and these things that we collect, that everybody collects now. Nobody did in the 70s, and they used to make fun of her for collecting junk. They used to call her the rag lady because she had all these costumes, the ones that she recently sold at auction for millions of dollars.
That's what I was going to say, those rags turned out to be very, very
important. And also, but she appreciated the historical nature of all these things. It wasn't just things to her. It was history. It was the history of the film people. And now the Academy is building a museum, and there's collectors everywhere where there never used to be. She was really a pioneer in that aspect also.
She did so many wonderful things, and it was always so heartbreaking that she had such a disastrous second marriage.
And third.
Well, yeah, both of them. Three of them.
She used to say, who would ever think that Eddie Fisher would turn out to be the good husband?
Yeah, that's true when you think about it. All three of them.
It was not hard.
What was her relationship with Eddie at the end?
She really didn't have one. Mm-hmm. I mean, she saw him occasionally. I don't think she was in touch with him at all. She was very careful with the children, never to speak badly of him while they were growing up. She never ever trashed him to Carrie and Todd, and both Carrie and Todd have told me this, that she was never, vicious about their father, because she didn't want them to feel that way about him. I mean, he did enough on his own that they had their own opinions, but it was her. She was very graceful in that she was careful not to turn them against their father.
Well, that's her nature. She has this wonderful, sweet personality.
Yeah, she's a peach.
And what about Elizabeth Taylor?
They were friends. They had been friends at MGM when they were growing up. They were in high school. The one room school held at said MGM. She was there with her, and Elizabeth didn't want to do her lessons because she was already a star, and she would lock herself in the bathroom because she didn't want to pay attention to her classes, and they were always trying to get her out of the Debbie said they were always knocking on the door to try to get Elizabeth to come back to school. But Elizabeth was a brilliant actress, and she really didn't need to learn algebra. It was just, she was a wonderful, wonderful person who, and after they both were remarried, they met on a cruise on the, when they were crossing from the QE2, and Debbie and her husband, Harry Carl, had one stateroom, and Elizabeth and Richard Burton had the other five first-class staterooms. So there were six of them, and Debbie and Harry Carl had one, and the, Richard and Elizabeth had the other five, because they had luggage and animals and, you know, dogs and people, and it was just, you know, that's how they rolled. And they sent each other notes when they found out they were on the ship together, and the notes crossed, and they said, let's have dinner, and they did, and that was the beginning of their friendship that lasted a lot longer than any of their marriages.
Well, I think that's a nice story.
It was very nice.
Yeah, it's very nice. Now, just to mention this second husband of hers, how did it happen? How did she let it happen?
Well, she said this was the age where the man was in charge, and she would take care of the house, and he would take care. She said he took care of uptown, and she took care of downtown. She was like, you know, made all the parties and kept the home and took care of the help and did all the things that needed to be done at home, and he took care of the business. And she didn't realize that he was at the Friars Club every day losing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, or at Hillcrest playing cards and playing cards with all these people that just really fleeced him. I mean, he would, you know, who would turn down this money? I mean, he played cards with all these supposed friends who just knew that he was going to lose and knew that he was good for it. They lost the homes. They lost all the money that she had made, all the money that he had inherited. It was really tragic. She just signed anything, and she didn't realize that what she was signing, because she trusted her husband.
And then she worked so hard to pay off all of these debts.
She certainly did. When I met her in 1981, she had just finished paying off all the debts from Harry Carl, and that was from a divorce that was like 8 or 10 years before that.
It's still, it's hard to believe that anybody could do that to another person in general. But that he could do it to Debbie Reynolds. She's, you know, we look back and we think, oh, wow, she was so, you know, sweet as a young girl, so beautiful and talented and somebody
and
who
bad
should.
Bad luck with men.
Yeah.
And the third husband, she was much more savvy and paid attention to what she was signing, but he just went behind her back and stole everything. So everything, her pension, everything he could get his hands on, he took. It was insane, and she was awarded $7 or $8 million in the divorce settlement and could never collect it. He just hid the money, and that was the end of it. So it was really unfortunate.
Well, I think the fact that she just overcame all of it and went out there and continued, you know, to perform, and, you know, as I said to you, I mentioned to you that I wrote a movie for her, and we were ready to.
Right.
To, you know, we were already talking to her agent and getting to the point, you know, you can't do a deal until we had all the funding in place. And I wrote this very funny movie called Sunshine Pilot about a World War II woman who becomes a pilot, you know, for the WAX. And it's a very, very funny movie that she's trying to save her airfield, you know, in her old age, and all the funny things that she gets up to. And it was written for Debbie Reynolds. I mean, I wrote the film for Debbie Reynolds, and we were so close. And then the collapse in 2008, that literally, I mean, our backers, I think some of them, they certainly passed out at the time, and many of them never recovered. So, you know, everything just... You know what happens when you lose your funding in Hollywood, and we never got to make that film, but it was exactly to capture this personality of hers of not giving up and facing all the hardships with a smile, and the amazing things she's accomplished, and we're all so proud of her when we think about her films and watch her films and you know. She, my goodness, she got to meet the Queen, right?
Yes.
How'd she feel about that?
Oh, she was thrilled, of course. She was on stage with Prince Philip. She was met the Shah of Iran, who was a friend who wanted her to perform and gave her, you know, all kinds of. She performed for a party there for his niece, who was getting married, and she was really, you know, he adored her. When Debbie was in London in 2010, I believe, and the Shah's brother came to see her at the theater. He was living in London. And it was, and she said he was the most handsome. He was Clark Gable handsome, the Shah's brother. So she was around royalty, but she loved everything. The thing I love about Debbie is that she includes everybody. You know, it's like it doesn't matter what you are, who you are. She's very inclusive. She just loves people, and she's. Takes care and adopts everybody, and we all call her mother, and you know, she's fabulous.
Well, I think that you've done a great job with this book, and I want to encourage people to get it. It's a perfect Christmas gift. I think it'll put a smile on everybody's face, and it's heartwarming and touching, and sort of makes you when you read the sad parts about the marriages, you think, well, you know, these things happen in everybody's life, and it's just wonderful to have this kind of personality that you don't give up.
That's exactly right.
And, of course, well, you are you have such a fascinating background, and I just want to ask, of all the, you know, stars that you worked with, you worked on the Letterman program.
Right.
And who are some of your favorite ones?
You know, my favorite person in the broadcasting realm that I worked with was Tom Snyder. As much as I love David Letterman, and I love him dearly, I worked with him peripherally, not every day, but Tom Snyder I worked with every single day, and he was so magnificent as a host, as a person, and he was just as goofy as he could be and fun and yet so brilliant, you know, as a broadcaster. He was a born broadcaster, and I learned so much from him. I think he was one of my favorites. But we would have people that come on, and so many people were really nice. We had very few people on our shows that we didn't care for. There were, you know, I must say they were very, not well-behaved, but they were very pleasant on our shows, you know. And I think that's a tribute to Dave and Tom, because they were really the kind of hosts where people felt that they could be themselves, and they were happy to see them.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dorian, for coming on today and talking about Debbie and talking about yourself, because you're as fascinating as everything.
Oh,
and
thank you.
It's just wonderful that you've worked together with Debbie and come out with a book that I think people will treasure and will enjoy. And whether, you know, a young person gets it for themselves, just because so many young people are interested in Hollywood trivia and
right.
Hollywood. And it's funny. One of the things is I had a writer on a week ago and coming up also about trivia, because trivia is so popular.
Right.
And so it's just wonderful. And one of the categories is always movies, you know,
so
they can prepare themselves for that. So it's a great gift, actually, for young people. It's a great gift for older people who, you know, if you have a grandmother or somebody who lived in the 50s, and they all were hooked at the time. What was the magazine? What did everybody read in those days? That there was a magazine that had all the gossip. And I can see it in my mother's hand. She used to read it like.
Isn't that TV Guide?
No, not TV Guide. It was a sort of a.
It was like Modern Screen or one of those.
Yeah, one of those. And every week it would be Debbie Reynolds, Eddie Fisher.
Oh, I went through her scrapbooks when we were writing Make 'em Laugh. She has scrapbooks where there were like four magazine covers on a page. Full of them.
Oh,
I mean, they were on every cover.
Everything. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful book for anybody who has somebody who remembers those years. They'll love this book. So it's an ideal Christmas gift. And I want to thank you so much for being on. And we're going to leave with one last song from Debbie Reynolds, one of my favorite. And I want to thank you again, Dorian, for being on.
Thank you.
Okay. And have a happy, happy Thanksgiving. And give our love to Debbie and tell her that we love her and that we think of her. I think of her every morning. And my, you know, my entire family knows that I can't sing like her, but I do try to keep her spirit.
That's
always
wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. So thanks again for joining.
Jesse.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye now.
I didn't want to do it. You made me want you. And all the time you knew it, I guess you always knew it. You made me happy sometimes. You made me glad. But there were times when you made me feel so bad.
You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. You made me want you. And all the time you knew it, I guess you always knew it. You made me happy sometimes. You made me glad. But there were times when you made me feel so bad.
You made me sigh for. I didn't want to tell you. I didn't want to tell you. I want a love that's true.
Yes, I do.
Indeed, I do.
You know I do.
Give me what I cry for.
You know
you got the brand of kisses that I die for. You know you made me love you.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a wonderful song, and Debbie Reynolds is wonderful, and I just want to tell everyone that we're getting ready for Thanksgiving, and we're going to have on the Thanksgiving Day program Mary Higgins Clark and James McGee. And I just want you all to be prepared for that on Thursday. And meanwhile, just remember Debbie's spirit and my spirit, and try to find something nice to say to somebody today, and find your joy and share it, and start thinking about how you can preserve your memories of your family and your friends, just like Debbie's memories are now in a nice book that you can all buy for Christmas. So make them laugh today. Just make them laugh. That's Debbie Reynolds' message to all of you. Bye.